Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
And we're off.
Yay. So I'm just going to apologize straight off the bat. I'll be sniffing. I will not be able to say the letter N at any stage. Or D. Well, fine. When you say... D. I won't say D.
I want someone to do a supercut of every time a podcast host is like, I'm so sorry that I have this respiratory
Exactly.
During our recording.
Will somebody get us another drink?
Welcome to Jim and Tomic's Musical Theater Happy Hour, the only musical theater podcast with root beer floats and musical notes.
Come through, rhyming. We've gone beyond alliteration.
Jimmy wrote that one and nominate him now for the annual Stephen Sondheim Rhyme Award.
Thank you. I will take that. Root beer floats and musical notes. That flows really nicely.
It does. That's a thing
that's beautiful.
Yeah. I never know the right word for it, but I think like one of the things a lot of lyricists get wrong about rhymes is they get the actual like sounding alike of the syllables correct, but then the meter of the rhyming words is incorrect, which like I do think a rhyme, to call it a rhyme, you need both.
As in like you wouldn't say this like that.
You couldn't say if it was just the only musical theater podcast with root beer floats and notes, it wouldn't be as good of a rhyme
as musical notes.
Root beer floats and musical notes.
Yes. Sorry, what I thought you were talking about was that other thing that Sondi talks about where it's like when you're scoring a word, you put the intonation where the intonation would go in the word.
Yes.
So like...
Yes.
Anticipation, your double note would be on
pay. Right. Yeah, like you put you'd write the rhythm of the word as it's naturally written.
Yes.
And if you don't do that, then it sounds stilted.
Exactly, it just sounds odd and bad.
Yeah.
And it happens a lot.
It happens a lot, and I will say, this will be a conversation I imagine we'll come back to about this show.
Hooray! Foreshadowing. So root beer floats, never had one. What are you drinking?
Clearly, a whole bowl of gazpacho.
Have you ever had gazpacho?
No. It sounds... I am mildly allergic to tomatoes to begin with.
Oh, gosh. Rash?
Yeah, I turn red, which is funny.
Yeah.
So I would be nervous around gazpacho. Yeah. But...
Oh, my God.
Sounds unappealing.
Violet Beauregard, right?
Yes.
Turns violet.
Right.
Tommy...
Ato. Tommy Ato.
Turns... Yeah, your last name is Ato.
Clearly.
You're Japanese. you return red with a tomato. There's something there.
There's something there. Call Roald Dahl. What are you drinking today?
I am drinking some sangria.
There you go. Clearly.
It's divine. It's delish. In fact, I had sangria and gazpacho for the first time together at the same time.
Really? I do love sangria.
I mean,
what more could you want from a drink?
Exactly. You ever been to Spain?
I've not been to Spain.
Cool.
I would love to go.
It's nice.
Speaking of Spain, you have a quiz question for us.
I do. I'll say it in Spanish. In what show does Miss Patty LuPone do her best Elphaba impression and fly at the end of Act 1?
What could it be?
I think it's women on the verge of a nervous breakdown.
Welcome to the edge, the verge, the ledge, the bridge is out. We're looking in the mirror, baby, is this where it rips? A tear, a tear, a fear that what's been coming isn't coming, cause it's here now.
7 miles up, you walk the wire, it's normal. At least you've got your friends around you, similarly lacking half their wits. You're on the hill and throwing fits and going down together. Listen to you shout, the brakes are out, the car's okay, but where's Louise? Isn't this a trip? You've lost your grip, you're coming to the end.
Okay, women on the verge of a nervous breakdown.
Women on the verge of a nervous breakdown. Not
should we call it women?
I, you know, but even if you call it women, are you talking about little women? Like,
true.
I see it shortened to either women on the verge or on the verge a lot of times.
On the verge. I like that.
But still not
I'm going to call it Nervy Break.
Nervy Break.
Yeah.
Music and lyrics by David Yazbek. Book by Jeffrey Lane. Based on a Spanish language film by Pedro Almodovar from 1988.
Oh, that's pretty good. That was good, Tommy.
Thank you. Well, thank you.
Yeah. It had its premiere on Broadway in the Lincoln Center in 2010.
And didn't it do very well.
It wasn't there well. It was not there well.
It was slated for a limited engagement to begin with.
Yep.
And still closed early.
Yeah, 69 performances, I think it was.
Oh, woof. Yeah.
It's not many.
No.
And then it opened up here, which is a surprise, in 2015.
Yeah, somewhat revised, correct? And I think we're going to talk about that.
Heavily
later.
Revised, yeah. Which we will talk about, yeah. And yeah, so it follows the plot of the film quite closely.
Mm-hmm.
It's a bit wackadoo.
A bit wackadoo is a good way to describe it.
Yeah. I'm not going to get into the intricacies of it because there's lots of them.
Yeah.
But basically, it kind of follows the life of this woman, Peppa, who is a film dubber.
Yeah.
She dubs, you know, a voice actor in a film. And she is trying to track down her lover who's left her. And kind of just gets caught up in a whole bunch of mayhem.
In a lot of farcical mayhem centered around pretty much the women that her lover has loved.
Yeah, basically, just the women that are in her life, whether orbitally or intricately.
Eventually ending up chronicling the, you know, crazy ridiculousness that I would say, what, maybe these four main character women have to live through in their lives and how it pushes you to the verge of a nervous breakdown.
Exactly. So, it's Madcap. Shall we dive in?
Let's dive right in.
Kersplash.
Madrid is my mama. Give me the nipple every day, I'm gonna taste it. Tons of mama milk and not a drop is wasted. Give me direction straight into the hurricane. Shake me up and take me to the heart of all the joy and all the pain. Put me to bed, I'm tattered up and torn. But every morning I come out and I'm reborn, reborn, reborn. Mama, mama, Madrid, I'm your baby. Bounce me in my buggy on the road, I'm born to pump on. I'm all right, or maybe I'm all wrong, but I'm taking this ride and anyone can jump on. When the trail gets stale, the same old view, just turn the corner and it's all brand new. Madrid, I love you, my big mama. Give me a little titty, cause I'm hungry every day.
So, this is our first Yazbek.
This is our first Yazbek. He, man, have you looked at his I haven't actually looked at his Broadway pedigree all written down next to itself until the right? show. He only works on movie adaptations. The Full Monty, Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, Women on the Verge, The Band's Visit, Tootsie.
That's interesting. Yeah.
That's it. Only movie adaptations. He's got a couple other things here and there, but that's his Broadway stuff.
The first thing I ever heard of David Yazbek was, of course, Where in the World is Carmen Sandiego?
Where in the world is Carmen Sandiego? Which, you know, if you don't know Yazbek's style, or like can't quite pin it, Where in the World is Carmen Sandiego is a good starting point.
Exactly. Like, just from then to now.
Yep. Tight, Carmen unexpected Sandiego rhymes. Like, wonderful, you know, as maybe we mentioned briefly, unless Jimmy cut it out of the episode. That tight scanning of rhymes and, like, coupled rhymes over the end of a line to the beginning of a line. It's beautiful stuff. And you can see it in things that he's done that people really like and things that he's done that people don't really like.
Yeah, totally. Because he is very much a consistent music and lyricist.
Yes. He will do both. Much. And I think even in spite of him having a style very much in that like Sondheim-esque way, still each of his pieces very much has its own appropriate musical sound.
For the most part.
You can still...
It has a distinct musical sound.
Yes.
But there's so much crossover.
Oh, yes. Oh, there's parts of Women on the Verge that, like, sound like underscoring lifted directly from Dirty Round Scoundrels. Like, note
Completely.
For note. And, like, down to instrument choice and rhythmic choice.
Yeah.
And what is interesting is, like, his style is very unique, so I don't mind it as much. It is very
much
his own.
I completely agree. Yeah. I wanted to talk about this a bit because it's such a strange one because you would think any sort of replication between musical would be a bad thing because you're not being original. You're
right.
contriving from your own.
Yeah,
thing.
you're not being appropriate to the source material.
Exactly. Yeah. Now, I'd say there's no bigger culprit of this than Stephen Sondheim himself.
Yeah. Sure.
You know, there's bits you'll be listening to Merrily We Roll Along and then you'll get lost and you'll suddenly be listening to Assassins.
Right.
There's so much that's the exact, you know, I mean, it's not even like little bits.
Yeah.
It's just like complete crossover.
I would say, and I wonder if it is just because of Sondheim's compendium of work and much longer writing career than Yazbek. Like, Full Monty was 2000 and Tootsie was just this year, so we're only talking about two decades. Like, in Sondheim, I can still, like, and maybe it's because I've been mired in it so much and I've convinced myself that they're different. But, like, between, you know, early work and later work, I hear distinctive voice come out and change and mold and craft. You know, even between the 15 different versions of Bounce, like, you can hear, I can hear, and maybe I'm making it up, slight differences in style that are distinct. Whereas with Yazbek, there are, like, dun 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 dun, like, distinct rhythms and instrumental choices that, you know, if I heard out of nowhere and was like, this is from a new musical, I would be like, oh, did David Yazbek write it?
Yeah.
Whereas, like, yeah, I don't know if I could do that with Sondheim. And maybe that's also just because so many people have imitated Sondheim's sound. Whereas Yazbek
potentially,
is certainly...
I don't know. I feel like this is something I would love to do at one point, is just sit down and pull them all out. Like, all of these times that I've been like, that, and a lot of them come back to Assassins,
which
I find quite odd. And Merrily, those two seem to be at the core. Because Sunday does it. Sweeney Todd doesn't really do it.
Sweeney Todd doesn't do it as much. Into the Woods doesn't do it as much.
No, Into the Woods does.
It does for you. It really doesn't for me.
It really does. I just feel there's those. No, but what I'm saying here is, I don't. It's actually, to me, it's not a bad thing.
Right. Well,
because it's all good stuff.
Right. It doesn't seem inappropriate for wherever it's used, whether it's Sondheim or Yazbek.
Absolutely. And so I think that's the thing is that I feel, you know, some people could say oh, he just writes the same thing over and over again. But it's not. It just always feels distinct.
Compared to, say, like Jerry Herman taking We Need a Little Christmas and turning it into It Takes a Woman between Fame and Hello, Dolly, right?
Yeah.
Like, he just had a tune that he liked, and that tune was appropriate for the kind of song that he wanted this to be.
Uh-huh.
You know,
and but that's the thing, though, is like through orchestrations and through, you know, backing and everything like that, and, you know, mixing up voices, they become very distinct songs, even though they are literally the same.
Literally the same song. Even, and like maybe less of a lifted melody note for note, but listen to the title songs of Mame and Hello, Dolly, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Exactly the damn same. And completely. You don't, like, I think, you know, if we're creating a scale, Jerry Herman is on the, you know, far 10 end of that. And like Sondheim and Yazbek fall a little further back towards maybe 6 or 7.
Yeah. But I don't know. I think it's just a sign of a good composer, maybe, because I think like Bill Finn does it a lot.
Mm-hmm.
If you listen to Spelling Bee, if you listen to some of Falsettos, there's a lot of crossover there. A New Brain.
Yeah.
A New Brain just feels like a training ground for
Spelling Bee.
I mean,
yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Well, it makes you wonder about musical theater composing, like, because we are such a small sample size to begin with.
Exactly.
Like, you know, I've tried to, it's been a draft script of mine for years, and I can never quite get it out. But like, diagnosing what is the quote unquote musical theater sound, and once you start diving into it, there isn't one. You just get the sound of particular popular composers who have done so much that then people imitate.
Yeah.
You know, and then you point at that, which then people qualify as a musical theater sound, but it's really just, you know, lifting Cole Porter or lifting Rodgers and Hammerstein or
completely
whatever.
Everything came from, which then could probably go right back and be like, well, they're just lifting it from
You know, the vaudeville stuff at the time, or
Gilbert and Sullivan,
exactly, like, right. You know, how like is the musical theater sound just I am the very model of a modern major general down the telephone line?
exactly, which I think is just really funny. To think about. But no, I just feel with Yazbek, I think it is quite apparent, even, you know, with something like The Band's Visit, which is obviously very inspired by a certain sound.
Yes, for sure.
In the same way that Women on the Verge is also very inspired by this kind of Latin sound.
Latin sound, yeah.
There's still all this similar.
Yeah, I mean, listen to Welcome to Nowhere from The Band's Visit and, you know, Women on the Verge from On the Verge.
Yeah.
It's like he's doing what Herman did with It Takes a Woman and We Need a Little Christmas.
Yeah.
Not quite as closely, but this is how he writes that kind of song.
Exactly. And that new one, we talked about it in Tony's episode, the one in Tootsie.
The one in Tootsie.
The Patter song.
Which I can't remember right now. But, oh, man. Yeah hold that up to Model Behavior.
Yeah.
Word for word.
Same song. Yeah. same idea.
I challenge anyone. No one is more consistent and effective with their patter songs than Tony Yazbek. David Yazbek. I'm going to do that a couple more times in the show.
That's okay. Who's Tony Yazbek?
He's an actor. I don't think they're related. Tony Yazbek was in On the Town in the recent revival. He was in Finding Neverland. You know, he's done a bunch of other stuff, so they live in the same corner of my brain.
I mean, there's not many Yazbeks out there.
You'd be surprised.
I've got
60 of them in my closet right now. No.
Big weekend.
Yazbek's patter songs are the most consistently brilliant patter songs in all of musical theater.
And at the moment, I would say not done very often in auditions. So if you need one for your book.
True. Yeah.
Get them in there.
Yeah. And I will say, well, I'd have to take a look a little closer, because people say, no, you know, don't do Sondheim at auditions because you don't want to challenge your accompanist. And I think I would wonder if that was advice given to me when I was in high school. And I wonder if some of that advice has fallen by the wayside simply because of Sondheim's popularity.
Yeah, well, the one that I always hear is don't do Jason Robert Brown.
Right. Because he throws that at your accompanist.
A dick when it comes to piano, right. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I wonder if there's a market for that. We should tell, because Jason Robert Brown is picky about these things, he should write a, like, piano vocal book of his songs with, like, simple piano.
Yeah, like four auditions. That'd be amazing.
I bet you he'd sell hundreds of copies.
Yeah, he totally would.
I wonder how much for a loop you're throwing your accompanist if you throw Yazbek at them. Because I bet you they don't know it. Like...
Well, this is it. And, you know, when you're dealing with Latin rhythm, although I guess for this, it follows the kind of Latin sound.
Yeah. And it's
quite
certainly,
well.
It's
so if you've
flows.
Got a vibe for that.
Yeah. And
then you could probably work it.
Yeah. And like, even I would say Yazbek's patter songs are more predictable in melody and structure than like sometimes a tonal bullshit.
completely, because it very much the rhythm is a riff.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? That will slightly change chord. Yeah.
And I mean, I do think that's his success, is the music goes where you expect it to, and the lyrics, often the content of the lyrics, don't go where you expect them to.
Exactly. Like, they're very much, yeah, it's traditional patter song in the sense that it is complete wordplay.
But then
it's a lot of fun.
But then we're going to take two stanzas about a raisin and a spider. Like,
yes, totally. But it works.
It works so well. Like, that's the thing. It doesn't
seem... And it still scans.
And it still scans. And it doesn't seem... Unlike, I would say, if we're, you know, still on the bent of contemporary shows, like some of the lyrics in, say, Beetlejuice, where, you know, we're kind of in that, like, haha, look, it's a spork level of humor. Like,
yes.
I'm just going to say a funny random word because that's the kind of character I am. Like,
yes.
The out-of-left-field stuff that happens in Women on the Verge still... is suitable and appropriate despite it being zany.
Totally. It's intelligent.
Yes.
And it helps the characters as well. Like, because, yeah, if you compare what Peppa sings to something that Candela sings, they're very different. Like, Peppa's stuff is actually quite artistic and quite metaphorical.
Oh, yeah.
Candela's stuff is probably a lot more straightforward.
Yes, straightforward or, like... There's not a lot of... She doesn't sing in a lot of metaphor.
She really doesn't.
Where, you know, Peppa has a full... I mean, you know, what is it called? Lovesick?
Lovesick, yeah.
And Not Castle on a Cloud. Man, I won't know the names of any of these songs.
Are you talking about Island?
Island, yes.
Yeah.
You know, is full-on metaphor. Like, an island in the clouds with extra closet space. Like,
totally.
It's
and
so
it
wonderful.
Just it's great because it shows you instantly, like, Peppa is the kind of the smart one in the friend group,
right?
And Candela is a bit less so, but has lots of heart.
It's, yeah,
you know,
yeah,
sweet, I mean, and relatable.
That is a good sign of a clever character lyricist that
Completely.
You can, you know, match words to that.
Yep.
You know, I put this in the show notes because I want to talk about it, but I encourage people to do this with any good lyrics that they enjoy, to explore the internal rhymes. There's a stanza from Lovesick where Peppa says, "You think that Cupid's got a bow? Well, no. Cupid's got a needle. It'll find a vein. Careful, because you'll bleed a little." I love this tiny little phrasing.
Yeah.
Because, like, there's the end of line, "got a bow? Well, no." End of line, beginning of a line rhyme. Which we then do again, not with a rhyme, but with some, it's not alliteration because it's in the middle, but Cupid's got a needle, it'll find a vein. And then needle, little, needle, it'll rhymes with bleed a little, which is such, when you split the rhyme at the line break, it is such a little clever twist of a thing that, you know, if you're listening to it for the first time, of course you don't notice, but just gives you that tinge of like this. Oh, this is a funny song. This is a clever song, a comedic song, but not doesn't need to be laugh out loud funny in this moment. Like these lines perfectly capture, I think, some of the core of the success of the show. There's also in Model Behavior, even just the simple like. Matador and metaphor is like there's just tiny little clever lines in here that aren't lazy
yeah
like
all the steady trickle from the umbilical
yeah
like
this, if you are a musical theater student or studying musical theater history or anything, it is totally worth it to get the libretto in front of you and get a couple different colored pens and circle every rhyme that you can find, even if they're on opposite sides of the song, because you may find that they've put the same rhyme in each verse on the second line, which isn't an ABAB rhyme. Like, there's, you know, really, really deep rhymes that happen all the time. That are so, like, as someone who from time to time makes parody songs on the internet, I think one of the things I try and do, and one of the things that makes a good parody song for me, is to not only keep the rhyming scheme the same as it is in the original song, but also attempt to rhyme and match the words that already exist in the lyrics you're parodying.
Yes.
Like, this is what makes a good Forbidden Broadway song, like... You know, this is where the cleverness comes, and it is work that is hidden, and so you're not supposed to see it, and so it's worth it to go in and study it. And things like, you know, I made a less articulate tweet about it, a couple months ago, because most of my tweets are pretty articulate, but in It Justifies the Beans, only three more tries and we'll have our prize when the ends in sights, you'll realize at the end. And it's not even that. There's like seven rhymes in a row there. And I've listened to Into the Woods a bazillion times and didn't even notice that rhyming line began as early as it did.
Yeah.
Because it just flows so well, and when it flows well like that, you don't even think about it.
You just don't. It just glides through you, and it feels great. Yeah. You know what I mean, you're enjoying the song, you don't really know why.
Yeah.
It's interesting. So, Aeneas Mitchell, weirdly, posted a thing on Instagram the other day.
Okay.
And it was a quote. I don't know if it's her quote or somebody else. Doesn't say who it's attributed to. It says, "Wordplay is not the same thing as poetry."
Oh, I saw that. Yes.
Right. And I thought that was really interesting, because I get it. I totally get it. But I think with musical theatre writing, like good musical theatre writing sits in between the two of them.
Someone framed that and put it on Tumblr. Yeah. Because
do you know what I mean?
Absolutely. Because that gets to, you know, Sondheim talks about it being his problems with Oscar. Was that like his lyrics for West Side Story were, you know, far too metaphorical and languid, and like written down, they looked like poetry, and sung, they just seemed kind of bullshitty. And then I think for a while, Sondheim kind of, you know, swung the pendulum in the opposite direction. And I think you're right that it does sit right in the middle of those two things. Good musical theater lyric writing
just straddles it nicely.
Yeah.
And I would honestly say that I think David Yazbek does it very, very well in this show.
I think he does it very well. I'm interested, and we'll talk about this later, #Jim and Tomic's Musical Theater Happy Hour.
Getting on the t-shirt.
Yeah. But I wonder sometimes if some of the... I wouldn't say ease, because none of these lyrics are particularly easy, or frankly, I would wager, memorable. May have something to do with how critics felt about the show and how shortly it played.
Yes. Was that a segue?
It can be. Let's get on. Here we go.
I think it was.
Do you just watch it all disappear, almost within reach, vanishing away?
You can find so much, you can lose so much.
So yeah, this didn't do too well on its first outing.
No, it did not. And I don't often talk about this, and I don't always seek out, you know, and if we're being proper, an archival recording of productions when we're working on this. But this one is a little, I think, hard to follow on just the cast album. And so I was looking for one. It's hard to find.
Yeah, it is. And certainly in its entirety, I've never found it.
Yeah. And because what? It only played, what did we say, 69 shows?
69,
You know, this was a flash in the pan. And I think interesting that it is still, I don't think it has had a great life beyond its closing, but still isn't totally gone. Like, there are some shows that are like, no one talks about Amazing Grace anymore.
Yeah, like, Scandalous.
Yeah, all sorts of flops that are gone. Woman on the Verge is still around, which is fascinating to me.
I wonder if that's because of the film. Like, the film is popular.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, so many people have seen that film.
The film is popular, and I watched a bunch of clips. It's very funny.
It's a great film. It's a really good film.
It's really, really good. And this production was... Wikipedia puts it very nicely. Wikipedia says, the show baffled critics.
Yes.
And I found, I think it was Broadway World's rundown of all the contemporary reviews.
Mm-hmm.
Can I read you some of them?
Please do. Can you read Ben Brantley's closing paragraph?
Oh, I don't know if this is, I don't know if this is the closing paragraph, but this was the line that stuck out to me from Ben Brantley of the New York Times. Miss Scott, Miss Lapone, and Mr. Mitchell, marvelous though they all have been elsewhere, here seem to be preoccupied with other matters, like where they'll be having dinner after the show. In that sense, I identified with them completely.
Yep. That was his closing paragraph of the review.
Oh, man.
That's biting. And actually quite insulting. Like,
this is why I'm like, the times when I'm nervous that I'm gonna become a critic, I then remember, like, oh no, I'm not, like, mean.
Yeah, exactly. Like, because that's then insulting them as a professional,
right? Like, you can, I think, and I think this is something we strive to do, and is, I wish, was more of a virtue of people who talked about musical theater. But, like, you can talk about a show critically and negatively without being a dick about it.
Unless it's Cats.
Unless it's Cats. That's true.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's so one exception.
you're completely right. Like, it's art we're talking about here.
Right.
So you have to be objective.
Yeah, and part of it is, like, you know... Like, people love reading this stuff from Ben Brantley, right? Because because it's salacious, because it's gossip, right?
It's sassy.
That's stupid. You know, but, like...
It's not a helpful review.
No.
Do you know what I mean? It feels like a bitch fest, and it's not... doesn't really tell me enough about the show...
Right.
...that would make me, A, want to see it or not want to see it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It doesn't go in on it enough.
And across the board, I mean, here, let's find something a little more credible. Variety, Steve Susskind. Blessed with some delicious performances and any number of items of interest, but the result can be summed up as women and men on the verge of a coherent musical. You know, less credible. Showbiz 411. They all try valiantly to rescue this piece of sludge, a show that is so misorganized that it's almost like an SAT test to try and reorder the scenes to make the show make sense.
Dear.
New York sludge. One Time Out magazine. There's a 20-foot-high recipe for gazpacho printed on the curtain that rises on Lincoln Center Theater's Woman on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown. If only a giant recipe for making a decent musical had been available to the makers of this Broadway letdown, which squanders so much stage talent. Like, whoo, man.
Yep.
That's, you know, I don't like that.
I don't like it either because, right... So the film is what, like, it's a farce.
Mm-hmm.
It's out and out farce. Like, farce doesn't often make sense.
Yeah.
And the thing is, it's not pure farce.
No.
It's like arty farce.
It's an arty farce.
Arty farce.
And I wrote this down later, but it is, you know, and maybe we'll come back to this when we're out of the review section, but it is like an interesting send up of melodrama as a farce. I would wager.
Yeah, it's got that, totally. It has that vibe. Like, everything is just a bit heightened.
Yeah, it's like a farcical parody of melodrama. And you can look at even the content itself, that, like, Peppa is a you know, dubbing artist for melodramatic films. Like,
completely.
You know, this is written into it. But, oh, man.
Because actually, like, watching the film, I'm a huge David Lynch fan, right? Mm-hmm. Who uses melodrama to great aplomb.
Absolutely.
In so much of his work. And there was a few, because I don't really know Almodovar's stuff, I just know this. Mm-hmm. But I know he has, like, a style.
Yeah.
And I wonder if that's a similar thing, because there were so many times when I was watching it, I was like, oh, this feels a bit Lynchy.
Yeah.
And that is, that melodrama, it's where things are just that, it's just too...
Are just so over-heightened.
Ridiculous.
And the villain twirls his mustache, and the damsel in distress jumps out a window, like...
Completely. But it's all very sincere.
Right. Like, you know, Peppa throws her phone out the window, but she absolutely deserved to in those moments. And, like...
Completely.
You know, when a lot of things fall from the sky in this show. The shoe, and there's suitcases that get thrown out the window at some point.
Yep.
You know, but it all seems funny and appropriate at that moment. You know, there's even a line in the show in Act 1 where, mm-hmm. like... If you've only listened to the cast album, the plot of the show is a lot more complex than the cast album would lead you to believe. Peppa leaves a card on a table that gets mistaken as a card for real estate listing, and sends her lover's kid to her apartment in a vast mix-up. And she realizes this and says, I left the card for your dad. Then your mother swooped in, and then somehow it's the classic Act 1 farce complication, is a line in this show.
Yep.
About the classic Act 1 farce complication that happens in this show. And, like, you know, it seems like a lot of that bouncing around rubbed critics the wrong way.
It's not that different from the film, which makes me be like, well, what are you talking about? Yeah. I think it's a really good adaptation of the film.
I think it's a good adaptation of the film. I will say, Act 2, which a lot of reviews bring up, does lose a lot of steam for me.
Yes.
And fall apart pretty quickly. Like, for me, the climax of the show, they're in Peppa's apartment and the cops come, and it is perhaps one of the most farcical parts of the show. It is very funny. It is filled with tension. You want to know what's going to happen next. And then Patti LuPone grabs two guns, runs out, and then there's, like, a car chase scene, and then another scene, and there's, like, six more scenes that happen in the show. And at that point, I am kind of lost. And as well, I think, like, Tangled Up, as much as it's a great song, there was, I can't remember which Pirates of the Caribbean it was. I want to say it was the third one, which I've only seen once, which is why I don't remember this. But there's, like, the chest with Davy Jones's heart in it.
In fact, the third one, yes.
But
exactly
also the heart itself, and, like, is the heart in the chest, and is Davy Jones on Johnny Depp's side, or, you know, like, who's on whose side? And there's one point where finally, like, all of the highest paid stars in the film stand on the sandbar, and three of them are standing on one side, and three of them are standing on the other side. And it's clearly, that was the point where, like, the script doctors came in and were like, hold on! You have to, like, show people who's versus who. Like, pause, you know, put up the, like, Super Smash Brothers team battle logo so we know who's on red team and who's on blue team. And, like, that's what Tangled Up is in this show. It's a well-written song, and also I don't think serves its purpose entirely well, because you still kind of leave Tangled Up a little bit like, wait, who? What? Why do they know? This all happened so fast.
Yeah.
I don't know why.
And the song was too catchy for you to actually listen to anything.
Right, exactly. And it happened so fast and is filled with such clever wordplay that you're like, oh, no, but I just needed to know. We're tangled up, but I need to know more.
Yeah. I think one of the things that I agree with a lot of the reviews on is the fact that, they open too many strands and they don't tie enough of them off.
Yeah.
Successfully.
Yeah.
And I think that is one of the things, because obviously in the film, it is actually very simple, and it's very much from Peppa's point of view.
Mm-hmm.
The whole thing, like she is, it's all centered around her. Okay. So you don't really find out that much about Lucia.
Yeah.
You don't really find out a vast amount about Candela. Certainly not about this relationship between Ivan and Marcos.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that is all woven into the musical,
right?
And I get the need for that because you can't just have Shuri Renee Scott,
right?
And
just
then
like on
everyone
stage
else
the
just
whole
sort of like,
time,
yeah, dancing around. I get that, but I think they open too many cans of worms. I think, in particular, the Ivan Marcos father son relationship, like that doesn't exist at all in the
and
film,
and is never really terribly important in the musical.
No, not really, because the only thing I can see it lending itself to is so Marcos is quite like sex crazed, and there's a line in the film, I've never read the script, so I don't know if it's in the libretto, but where his mother Lucia says, oh, you're just like your father.
See, and I think there are a couple lines in the book of the script where Marco, and what's his girlfriend's name?
Marcia?
And Marco's girlfriend. Like
Marisa.
They'll be in Peppa's apartment, and Marisa falls asleep. This is what it is. She falls asleep because she accidentally drinks the gazpacho with the Valium in it.
Yeah.
And Peppa or someone makes some comment about to Marco about, like, does she always snore like that? And he says, oh, I wouldn't know. And Peppa is like, oh, okay. And, like, they make that comment a couple times about, like, oh, you don't sleep together, do you? So, you know, perhaps almost a reversal in the musical. Then why, right?
But he's so in love with Candela, and well, in this like inverted commas love that happens in 2 seconds.
Yeah.
And I think it's just that it's the sex crazed boy who will stick it in anything.
Yes. Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like that kind of thing. And I think it's Marisa, you get the feeling anyway, that she has closed herself off to it.
Mm-hmm.
Because at the end, again, in the end, at the end of the film, it ends with Marisa and Peppa having a conversation on the balcony, and Marisa she's had a sex dream, and she's like, I don't really feel like I'm a virgin anymore. And then Peppa's like, oh, you kind of seem a bit chiller, this is great. And then they just have a chat, and then that's how it ends.
Yeah.
Is that how it ends?
It's pretty close to how it ends, yeah.
Okay, yeah. So I think that's quite funny in a way that, you know.
I do think that ending, that kind of ending, and I think this is one of the struggles with Act 2, is that kind of ending is very much film funny, but is more difficult to make musical theater funny.
Yeah, because you can't end on a... You can't end on the little
sign. You can't end and, like, zoom out from the balcony and, like, up to an aerial shot of Madrid, which is how that kind of feels like it ends. And that's much harder to do in a musical.
Yeah, because you need a button. You need an ending.
Yeah, you know. And I think that is one of the difficulties of this adaptation, which does draw into question, you know, the eternal... struggle about, like, how much can you adapt your source material?
Very, very true.
How much can you adapt it to the medium you're working in? Like, I don't know if you've ever... Have you ever experienced the Spitfire Grill, the musical?
No.
It's a real popular community theater piece because it's got, like, 5 girls and 2 guys.
Right, okay.
I won't go into it too much, but it's about a released felon who worked for the state tourism board phone lines. And so knew a lot about like all the good places to go. And so decides to move to this tiny, tiny sleepy town that she knows must be beautiful because she's described it all the time. And like gets taken in by this spinstress who owns the Spitfire Grill. And you know, kind of her like coming back to real life. And you know, kind of she has bonding moments with this old lady, and there's a love story and all these sorts of things. It's based on a movie. in both the movie and the musical, the lady who owns the grill auctions it off to a person who can write the best, description of something. I don't remember the details, but write in the reasons why you should own this grill and I'll give it to you. Right. In the musical, of course, the person who wins is the former convict and they celebrate and it's great. In the movie, the girl goes, I think she goes chasing after some kid, I forget what, and drowns in a river and dies.
Wow.
And that's the end of the movie.
Right.
And I was working on the musical once and was like, huh, I should watch the movie. And watched it and was like, oh, well, that's just an entirely different ending.
Yes.
Completely different. And you see this sort of stuff all the time.
Yeah.
With movie to musical
adaptations. Particularly in musical theater. Right. Yeah.
And so I wonder, if given the chance, if they would change their ending. I know, and perhaps this is a good transition, because according to this West End revival libretto,
Yes. They
did not change the ending, although they did change lots of other things that I found.
They changed the song.
Yes, a couple of them.
Well, they changed the finale.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
To make it more... It's a very similar vibe.
Mm-hmm.
But it's much more in line with what the film is.
Yes.
It's because both songs, they do both end very kind of relaxed.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? They're very nice, chill songs. But the Broadway version opens with this really like minor character. Concierge.
Yes.
Yeah. She starts to sing it, and then they all join in,
and it's
called Shoes from Heaven for some point of view.
Yeah.
And that's all well and good. It's a lovely song, but it's a weird ending.
It's
a weird-ass ending. But then in the West End version, it brings it back to where the film is, where it's more of this just nice conversation between...
women.
But talking about the view from the balcony, which is how the film ends.
Yeah.
So I think in that respect, that kind of makes more sense. Now, is that the correct button that makes it like, perfect?
Well, it is interesting. I've only skimmed through this, but there are, like, they use the taxi driver a lot more as a narrator in the West End version.
Very much so.
And this is a question I have. In the first number now in the West End revival, we introduce Iban's wife and say, this is his wife, right?
Yep.
In the Broadway version, Patti LuPone has a big hat and is like the mysterious woman through the first half of Act One, which is intriguing and exciting and also confusing. And so I wonder... I don't know. Was this production successful?
Probably a little bit more successful than the Broadway one. But I think there might be just more in it that was a bit stranger.
Yeah.
So I need to talk about the accents.
Of the London production?
Yeah. So they sing and speak in their own accents.
In traditional British.
Yeah.
Huh.
Tams and Greg's there chatting in, London.
Yeah.
RP. Candela is very North London. So, you know what I mean? It's fascinating.
Yeah.
It's so peculiar. And what I wonder, because there's so much a lot of the edits that they've done, you can, and the things that they've taken out and the things that they've put in, you can tell it's been in response to all of the reviews, basically, that they got.
Right. They focus grouped it.
Yeah. Oh, completely. They basically just took all those negatives and were like, right, we can fix that with that. We can fix that with that. We'll have more narration. We'll take out this song that's, fluffy. We'll give her less of a metaphorical song and much more of a specific one. Because, for example, with Lucia, they take out The bomb, down the song, stop.
Oh, yeah. You're right.
Time stood still.
Yeah.
Which is a great Patti LuPone moment.
Right.
Right? That's not in it, and it gets replaced with a song called It's Me.
Yeah.
Which is, it's a similar event. So she's going through the stuff, and she's listening to a record. She like hears Ivan singing to her,
mm-hmm.
and then she sings back at him. So it ties them together a
yeah.
lot more.
Yeah, yeah,
whereas,
yeah.
you know, if you weren't following the book and then suddenly she's singing, you don't necessarily realize how much of a history they have
right.
until much later on.
Yes.
So it puts right at the start, like, Peppa's in love with Ivan, and
it
so
sets
is
up their relationship. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and you know, it's just it's this kind of flagpole. Is it a better song? Absolutely not.
Yeah.
It's much worse. It's very right. simple and not very exciting.
Yeah.
But it's much more of a signpost.
Yeah.
And that's a shame.
Yeah. Well, I wonder, you know, it's 9 years later, like, our audience is smarter now. Can we count on, you know, a...
Well, I think we've talked about this before.
I'm sure we have, because that's, you know, Great Comet and the...
Well,
and
no,
Hades
I think
Town
we talked
and...
about it. And it's always something I always hesitate saying because it's probably not correct in any way. But about West End audiences
we
compared
have
to Broadway
about
audiences.
Yes.
And I think it was in Hades Town that we talked about this.
Yeah.
Potentially. And it's not necessarily the West End musical theatre audiences.
Mm-hmm.
It's the West End play audiences
mm-hmm.
who are a lot more open to your wanky art
mm-hmm.
and your, you know...
Yeah.
metaphorical songs and things
right.
like that. You know, they would be the ones that were like, oh, we only really see Sondheim. We don't see...
Right, we don't need to go see Mamma Mia.
Exactly. And I feel like they could probably take on the original.
Yeah.
As it is.
Yeah.
And hopefully get something out of it. I don't know if the Broadway audience... I don't know. That's
yeah.
their broad strokes.
But hard to say. Like, the people who are going to see Beetlejuice would not enjoy Women on the Verge.
Yeah.
Which...
But it's weird, though, because, like, it's not high art.
No. It's a bedroom farce. Like,
yeah.
It is, you know, Don't Dress for Dinner or, you know, Rumours. Like...
Yeah.
It's yes. nothing... Like, it is clever in its construction, but not in its conceit. Ooh, I like that.
That was good. That was
and
very
so,
good.
And so it makes you wonder, like, the much of the jokes, much of the, like, laugh-out-loud jokes result are, like, you know, potty humor, age, or boob jokes.
Yeah.
Right? So who knows? It's an
I know.
It's interesting. It's an interesting clash of, like... The accent thing baffles me too, because it is an interesting clash of cultures and, like, different what I would qualify as cultural ideologies.
Yes,
which is a tricky tightrope to walk.
Yes,
but I think one that is interesting to talk about around this show.
Absolutely. So let's talk about it.
Let's
you
do it.
Walk around scratching your head and repeating your phony. And the question is, which would you rather be, totally tangled or totally lonely? That's a thought you can keep in your mind. That's a knot you can try to unwind. That's a thing to be sure to remind yourself when you fall in the same kind of find yourself. And you lose yourself and you find yourself tangled up.
Tangled up.
Tangled up.
I'm tangled up.
Tangled up.
Most of the time,
like there must be some kind of
I want your tangled up wings. I'm tangled looking most of the time.
Like there must be some kind of
I want your tangled up wings.
Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
I wonder if one of these days, right, we're going to talk about race and representation in theater, and we're going to come across the answer.
You know, we'll keep searching.
It's the, like, million monkeys writing,
right?
You know, working on the typewriter, and one of them writes.
Yeah, will we find the solution? When I think one of the fascinating and interesting things specifically about Women on the Verge, is exemplified in the English translation of the Spanish language movie title, Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown, is technically incorrect.
Yes.
The Spanish title is Mujeres al Border de un Antique de Nervios. Pardon my sophomore level Spanish.
Well done. You dove right in there.
But the Antique de Nervios is a thing I know, is a medical condition, listed in the DSM, the diagnostic something. Like, this is where, you know, all different medical terms are listed. And more literally translates to an attack of nerves as opposed to a nervous breakdown.
Yeah.
And is a kind of Latino cultural concept that is different from a nervous breakdown. And it is kind of feminine in connotation, and, you know, perhaps might be more equitable to what Europeans would term the vapors.
The
vapes, right? Louder.
Hysteria,
right. And not, like, it's untranslatable, so we can't get to the right term, but we can talk around it a little more. And so,
female hysteria doesn't exist, like, that.
Right, like, and so already we're, like, mired in a bunch of chauvinism, right?
Yeah.
I would wager the original movie uses that, frankly, chauvinistic term intentionally, because it is blowing apart this conceit of, like, of course these women seem crazy because they're going through all this shit. You look at even Lucia's story arc, and that she was committed to a mental institution because of the craziness she was driven to by Ivan. Mm-hmm. And not because she's crazy, but because this was a terrible, terrible thing. And we're looking at it through this comedic eye and through this black comedy eye. And so already, from the moment you've seen the billboard, the card above the theater, we're coming at this concept through a couple different lenses that are mired through what are, frankly, translation errors.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, the first question is, is that okay?
Mm-hmm.
And then I think the answer is, yes. I think the answer is, we get as close as we can.
Oh, well, I mean, completely, because we have to.
Yeah. But
you know
what
I mean?
The second question, which is one I think we've maybe danced around, but I especially with us being on either side of the ocean, but talking about these, you know, different, you know, nationalistic and culturalistic touchstones that often come out in stories that don't quite make it to, you know, we talked about it last time with Ragtime, you know, don't quite make it or do quite make it, or, you know, transposing these different cultural touchstones to different cultures and how that happens and where the border is between, you know, appropriate examination of the other and stereotyping of the other. You know, and in our, you know, multilingual, internet-connected society nowadays, we run into this stuff more and more and more and more. I was listening to a tech podcast the other day that was going through all of the
like Netflix originals in, and not just Netflix originals, but like all sorts of television shows that were produced in certain countries that have become ridiculously popular in other countries, right, and how that happens right now. Like the Great British Bake Off is now ridiculously popular in America. And why, right? Is it because of the content of the show or because of some assumption we make about the quaintness of British people?
Well, exactly. That's the thing, is I think, you know, they watch it for different reasons.
Right.
Very much like for us, Bake Off is great. It's an institution.
Yeah.
And it's just, we like it because it's a refreshing reality TV show, because it's very behooving and empowering.
Yeah, and it's, you know, and it's
people
wholesome.
Are still getting eliminated, but they get big hugs. It's right. Lovely.
Exactly.
But I know for a fact, across the pond, everyone's watching it being like, oh my gosh, they say soggy bottom.
I know, right? And like, and I, you know, full disclosure, I've watched several seasons.
It's great.
And part of it is because it's a wholesome, nice break in my day. And part of it is because I want to hear the funny thing Mary Berry's going to say in a British accent.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
And like, it's, you know, I think it's more difficult nowadays to get in trouble online for your assumptions about British people. But when you start bringing other cultures, other nationalities, whatever kind of phrasing we want to put around these different peoples,
absolutely,
into it, it gets a little tricky. You know, are we assuming through a certain reading of this show that like Spanish women are crazier?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah, completely.
I don't think so, and I think this show handles it in an appropriate, well, manner, and because it is such an accurate depiction of the legitimate, you know, Spanish language, Spanish-produced, entirely Spanish film, that it is honest and natural, but
totally.
When it gets produced in, you know, Duluth, I worry that sometimes some of that might go away a little bit. Like, this is a very tricky thing, which even I think relates to just the accent discussion about producing it on the West End.
Yeah, completely. It's totally fascinating, because I think you watch it in any, whether it's the film or the musical.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it does feel insincere. I think the characters are relatable, particularly Peppa.
Yeah.
And you know, you could put it in any context, like put the story in any other country.
For sure, yes.
And I think it would be the same story, and it would be, you know what I mean? There's nothing about it that is intrinsically Spanish.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? There's nothing about it that's particularly Castilian.
Yeah, I agree. I would wager that where the musical is a bit of a tightrope, mm-hmm. is that it opens up with a song called Madrid Is My Mama.
Completely. But all I would say for that is it opens you up into that because it's like, this is the world that we're living in. But Madrid could be London. Madrid could be Glasgow. Sure. Madrid could be New York. It's just big city life. Yeah. I don't think it's necessary, because he doesn't say anything like, oh, it's the fountain in the square that makes me feel like this. Do you know what I mean? It's just the hustle and the bustle.
Yeah.
And every day you wake up and it's a new thing. Do you know what I mean?
So Madrid Is My Mama, give me the nipple every day, I'm going to taste it. The tears and the drama, 10 tons of mama milk and not a drop is wasted. There's some like feminine imagery in here that I'm at the very least curious about.
But then I to me that doesn't read though as like, oh, Madrid being female, like, again, you could say it wouldn't sound as good, but Glasgow is my mama.
That's fair. You know what I mean? Fair. Yeah,
because it's just that metaphor. Like, to be honest, I actually find Madrid a really interesting song. A, because it's the opening, and yes, you're setting up your world.
Yeah,
right. You're world building. But the metaphor is peculiar.
The metaphor is peculiar, and
it's very peculiar.
It is not, it, like, we don't need to compare it to, say, something like Iowa Stubborn from Music Man.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It is useful to know the mentality of the chorus in the Music Man.
Mm-hmm.
We need to know that generally these people are difficult to get along with and stuck in their ways. That is important to the story.
Yep.
There's not a lot In Madrid Is My Mama that is crucial.
Set up. And yeah. Again, that's something that got changed a bit for London. There's a few lyric changes in there that do bring it into this more, this idea of more, your whole life can change in a day.
Yeah.
That kind of vibe. Every day you wake up and it's a whole new day and you don't know what's coming. That kind of vibe.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think like, to me, it just kind of opens up this idea of women.
Yeah.
Like, this show is about women. We're focusing on female here. We have a man talking about his mother.
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
It's mummy issues here. It's not daddy issues.
Yeah. How do you feel about the representation of women in this musical?
I go back and forth, Tommy. I go really back and forth. I think it's one of those things, like, I'm not the person to talk about it.
Right, exactly, clearly.
Being, having a penis and being a man. For me, I don't, you know, I mean, there's times, obviously, where I'd be like, well, that's shocking, you know, all these, there's such broad strokes, all these women are crazy, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
And you're like, that's, you know, such shame. Or, you know, looking at it from the perspective of everyone's in love with Ivan.
Right.
You know, Marcos is having it off with anyone.
Yeah.
Like, these bastarding men. But then the ending happens.
Right.
And you're like,
I think the ending is, like, thank God, you know, Peppa doesn't get back with him. Like,
exactly.
And, like,
exactly.
Clearly, you know, and as the movie's written. But, like, if that had happened, this would not be a show I would want to talk about, like, full stop, right?
Yeah.
Because he's terrible. But I do struggle with the fact that, like, he's terrible and very charismatic as written, you know?
He is, but I think that's the point, because if he wasn't, you wouldn't get why. You wouldn't get why Lucia drove herself insane.
Sure.
You wouldn't get why Peppa is currently driving herself insane to get to that point of wanting him.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because he is, like, he is made out to be this philandering jackass.
Right.
As much as he is charismatic and delightful, it's you know, it's Brian Stokes Mitchell.
Absolutely. And he does a fantastic job. You know, part of me wishes there was just at least one, like, because most of his dickish moves in this musical end with you being like, oh, you, and like putting your hand on your hip and be like, you silly boy, that's a silly, you look at how silly you are. And like, I wish we saw at least just one moment of him being actually, you know, the asshole he is deep down inside.
But it's not even in the film that doesn't happen.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, he's barely in the film.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Which I also quite like, because it's this, you know, all he kind of does is exist in the end of this phone line.
Right.
And then if he comes close to seeing Peppa, he's away.
Right, he's just that mystery man.
Basically.
Yeah.
And what they do in the musical, I think it sort of flows along a similar line. Obviously, he's in it a lot more.
Yeah.
He needs to have a character there.
Yeah.
I don't think he needs the out-and-out jackass moment, because you're getting the sense from everyone else that he's a jackass. Even the way that he, you know, goads Marcos into doing, like, this is how you get women.
Right, this is how you, you know, let me show you. What is it, the microphone?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's an asshole-y thing to do. It's like, oh God, here he is, turning another one.
Right.
Because you're on the ride with Peppa.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know what I mean? You're not on the ride with Ivan. And there's no moment of like, oh, Ivan, that's a nice thing that you know what I mean?
Right.
There's no.
He doesn't have a redeeming, as much as he doesn't have a demonizing moment, he also never has a redeeming moment. That's
exactly.
Fair. Yeah.
Exactly. And actually, one of the things I would say that the musical might even do better than the film, which I guess, you know, might not make sense because it's
the, right, they're different medias. Yeah.
Yeah. But the character of Lucia, I think you get a lot more from her in the musical than you do in the film.
Oh, yeah.
In the film, she just kind of, she is a bit of a flash in the pan. She is just this crazy woman who overreacts to everything and then grabs a couple of guns.
Right, and goes running.
And then gets arrested. That's kind of her story. Yeah. Whereas you see a lot more of her backstory in the musical.
Yeah.
And how she got to this point.
You know? I love, and I'm sure it's just a Patti LuPone choice, but that she sings the title song as a narrator at the end of Act One, around, and like as this kind of omniscient around these other women who are experiencing being on the verge for the first time, and like she's like, oh honey, I've been there. This is what it's like. Yeah. You know, get ready. We're going to stand on some ropes. And they absolutely could have, structure wise, just had the taxi driver sing that song. Right?
Absolutely.
He could have come back in and been like, and here's, you know, to be continued, right? But it is important to have her, Lucia, entirely step out of the story for maybe, you know, one of the only moments in the entire show where she does this, at least as explicitly, and just narrate the action and get us into this song and take us out of... You know, On the Verge takes place basically in limbo. I mean, it takes place on a bunch of high-flying ropes above the stage.
It does.
But, like, and we take a break from the story for a second to talk about what's happening very clearly in these characters'
minds. It's that kind of, like, record scratch moment.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, how did I get you by word? Like, how I got here?
And that, that Lucia brings us there, and that it is, like, all of them and none of the men. Like,
yeah,
the men get a break during the Act 1 finale.
Yep. And the finale as well, which is lovely. So, yeah, representation of women. Is it the best? Probably not.
If we did it, if it hit the Tonys today, I think we'd be having similar conversations around it in style as we do about Tootsie right now.
But you compare it to something like Nine.
Yeah, for sure.
Where it's a bunch of women fawning over one man.
Right, yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And you're rooting for this man. Like,
it's a much better step.
Yeah, it's a lot of women working it out.
Yeah.
And that's good. That's a good thing.
It's a good thing. And, like, certainly doesn't pass the Bechdel test at all. I don't think there are any conversations. I don't think there's a single line in the show that's not about men. Maybe about a raisin. That might be that might be it.
You're probably right.
But in, you know, our, like...
That's a lie.
That's a lie.
The ending. The final conversation.
True. Oh, of course. Yes.
Isn't that nice?
That is nice. That we can kind of end like that.
Because that makes sense.
Yeah. That we've kind of put this behind it. You know, you've... This is why it's a hard one, but I think you've turned me more... At the beginning of this conversation, I would have been more on the side of, this isn't the best representation of women.
Yes.
And I guess I would still say, I don't think this is the best representation of women.
No.
But it has some redeeming qualities.
It does. And I think for a farce, for melodrama,
it
does the job as best as it can.
Oh, yeah. Name a bedroom farce that has good representation of women. I'll wait.
Oh god, exactly. At no point is anyone in a negligee.
Yeah, right?
And I think that's something to be celebrated.
Well, there is a point where when the cops walk in and Laura Benanti turns to the cops and Peppa's like, distract them, and she like just drops her dress. So
well, cool. She's using her sexual wiles.
She is using her sexual wiles, which I think she does. I think Candela, is a very powerful feminine character. In the same way that like Elle Woods takes some stereotypes and turns them on their head.
Totally. Like,
you know, yes, I am this, but that is not all I am. And like these stereotypes that men have created to put women down can be powerful.
Absolutely. You don't really quit. You know, I mean, they don't really ever go into the fact that it's like, oh, you're an airhead because you're a model.
Right.
She gets it out the way very quickly in model behavior, which is like, I'm a model, so I feel things differently than most people typically do.
Yeah.
And I fully think that she believes that. And I think that's absolutely fine.
And she spends the whole Act One being like, listen, my boyfriend's a terrorist, and I don't know what to do about it. And then spends a lot of Act Two being like, hey, I really think I like him, but I'm kind of nervous that he's going to blow up the courthouse. And that's a difficult circle to square.
Absolutely.
Which, you know, it would be so, like, only a couple differences, and she's a total, you know, a total stereotype of a bimbo throwaway character.
Yep. She's the maid in Noises Off. I can't remember her character
right,
name.
Right, exactly. And she doesn't have to be that in this. She certainly is, you know, tinges of that and flavors of that.
Uh-huh.
But is intelligent, is smart. You know, even just giving her the patter song, even though we talked earlier about her, you know, vocabulary not being as metaphorical as Peppa's, it is still fast-paced and clever. And, like, you know, she only has a couple moments of airheadedness, and therefore, you know, farcical comedy's sake. It is not the starting... Well, it is not the legitimate core of her character. It might be the starting point of her character, and then you explore more and you see what's down in there.
Exactly. Yeah. So I think, I've changed my mind. I think it's decent.
Yeah. But, you know, we're two men, so what do we
do? Exactly.
Peppa, are you there? Are you there? Are you okay or not there? But we need to talk. My stomach's aching like I swallowed some enormous rock. I'm at the phone booth on the corner and have only got a minute, cause I'm running out of change, cause I've been lending all my money to Malik. God knows with men I'm not exactly on a lucky streak, but this one really is a mess. I think I'm gonna freak. I know you say I'm an alarmist, but I'm not. Remember, there's that time I thought I saw a spider. You said, man, it's a raisin, but it suddenly started moving and it crawled over and bit me on the toe. So if you're gonna stand in judgment, that's how much you know. It's a good thing I didn't eat it, but I never would have eaten it, cause I never did like raisins, so why would there be a raisin on the floor? So when you hear this, call me back, I'll wait a little more. I'll be at 773. Damn, they scratched out the number and misspelled vagina. All right, I'm hanging up. I'll call you back.
What I do want to talk about, though, while we're on the tricky stuff, is, so I can't remember if I've spoken to you about this or not, so stop me if I have.
Okay.
I had a conversation with one of my friends in work, right, where we were talking about accents, right, and doing accents, and is that racist?
I work at a school, and I shadowed our middle school drama teacher one day, sat through all of her classes.
Yeah.
wonderful teacher, been teaching there for a long time. And I got to sit in on her middle school lesson about accents.
Yeah.
And I have never seen a more sensitive and appropriate approach to that topic, especially geared towards, you know, what, 6th, 7th, and 8th graders, 12, 13, 14-year-olds, about how it was very much couched in, we live in a world where people speak different languages, and we are different, and we come from different places, and people sound different. People you know might sound different. People across America sound different. And one of the things we're trying to do on stage is bring voice to other people, right?
Yeah.
We are embodying other people, and we want to do that authentically. And so it feels appropriate to embody the literal voice that other people would have if you're trying to also bring their more metaphorical voice to the surface. If you're trying to, you know, like... bring to light their story or whatever that is. But that can be a tricky thing then, because then that expands the topic into, well, what is the story you're telling about this other person? And that becomes the determining factor in whether or not the accent you've chosen is, you know, whatever word you want to choose, appropriate, acceptable, not racist. And it's a tricky line to draw, and it is not cut and dry, and people are going to get it wrong. But, you know, it's the difference between a blackface performer putting on a stereotypical, you know, black accent in the 20s and someone putting on a Wyoming accent doing the Laramie Project, right?
Yes.
Even if you're putting on a Wyoming accent in the Laramie Project to like play a gay bashing felon, right? There are lots and lots of layers to this that I think are an important part of the discussion. And of course, then the discussion calls into effect, you know, like should, like, this is a play filled with a bunch of Spanish characters. Is everyone who played these Spanish characters Spanish? Some of them, kind of, maybe, maybe not. How, like, is there an authenticity challenge there? Ooh, right? You know, we talked about this within The Heights, yeah?
Yeah.
And, like, I think a lot of that conversation comes down to, like, did, you know, what was your casting process like?
Mm-hmm.
Did you seek out, you know, authentically Spanish performers in it? Did you just take names? Does it, you know, were you just open to everyone? Like, I don't know if there is good answers to these things because it's difficult, because we live in one of the few professions that still, like, down and out segregates and, like, makes employment decisions full on the basis of gender and ethnicity and all sorts of what other professions would call protected classes.
Yep.
And the way we get around that is by making sure auditions are open to everyone, and there have been some wonderful things that have happened because of that.
Yes.
But still, we live in a world where you can write, like, you know, 40-something woman on your casting call, and, like, you're going to turn away men, or vice versa, right?
Yeah.
And people don't generally raise a fuss over that. Should they? Maybe. Maybe not. But, like, I think accents, you know, are mired in all of this.
Yep.
Because you are impersonating another person. You know, Women on the Verge is maybe one of the most interesting ones to discuss around this, because it is already a tale of dubbing. You know, like, they don't go into it in detail in the musical, and you can tell me if they do in the film. I imagine they don't, but, like,
not really. It's just at the start.
But in theory, they're dubbing English language films in Spanish, right? Because lots of popular films come out of Hollywood, which is an English-speaking locale, and is there anything wrong with dubbing them in Spanish? No, absolutely not. Right? Of course we want this art to go in other places. Then, flip that on its head, is there anything wrong with taking what was a Spanish-language film, basically translating it to English and then musicalizing it and bringing it to an English-speaking audience?
Yeah.
You know, it's...
But then, when you're doing that, are you doing it with a Spanish accent?
Right. Or not. And,
or are you doing it in your native accent?
And which one is more inappropriate?
Exactly.
Is a really interesting question.
Are you taking it away from Spain? Or are you empowering Spain, but maybe badly?
Right, exactly. You know, how accurate is your accent, too? Like, can you do a bad job? You know, we've talked about this with Americans doing British accents. And the Olivia performance of Hamilton, where they're doing, you know, just not quite right American accents.
Exactly, exactly. There's just little things that are wrong. Yeah, I just find it eternally fascinating, because I'm someone, I love accents. I love learning them. I love looking at the intricacies of them. I just find it utterly fascinating.
Yeah.
And at no point am I ever doing it in a mocking way. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's literally like a chameleon. You know what I mean? Anyone will say something to me, and at some point during that conversation, I'll repeat something that they say back to them in an attempt of doing their accent, because I'm just trying to form it in my mouth. Do you know what I mean? I'm just a curious person that.
It's like a voice exercise.
It genuinely is, and it's just curiosity, and it's just excitement. I find it really, really exciting. But when I was having this conversation with my friend, it started off, we were talking about Indian accents.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously I actually don't really know what it's like in the States, but we have, certainly in Glasgow, we've got a large contingent of Indian or Pakistan people. And there's, you know, because that's been that way for a long, long time, there's actually this really interesting kind of like blend of Pakistani accent and a Glaswegian accent.
Oh, that's fascinating.
That's become its own kind of thing. I'm obsessed with that, because that is so cool. That is, you know, culture. That's pure culture there. And obviously, I would love to learn how to produce that from my own mouth.
Right.
Absolutely. But the second I'm doing that, people are like, you're racist.
Mm. See,
and I'm like, I see the point, right? I totally see the point.
Yeah.
But, you know, if, and I, again, I don't know if this is right, and I don't know if this is a horrible argument to make, but if I was born in India and I grew up having Indian, like native Indian friends.
Right.
Say it was Delhi or something.
Yeah.
I would probably speak in an Indian accent.
Yeah.
I'm still white. I'm still Caucasian. Right. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
To the point. So to me, accent and race.
Oh, it is so mired. And accent and race and culture and location. And we conflate all these things and don't draw strict lines between them because it's hard to draw strict lines between them. But because they are mired, it becomes problematic. I have a friend now who he is the son of missionaries who moved to Africa like 60 years ago, was born in Africa, you know, white as a sheet, is legitimately an African American in that he is from Africa and lives in America.
Yeah.
But African-American has become shorthand for black people, inaccurately so in a lot of cases.
Exactly.
But, you know, it is hard. All of these lines are difficult to go through. And I think you're right. Like, the combining, as an example of the Glaswegian and the Indian accent, is culture in the same way that, like, bringing this intranslatably titled Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown to an English-speaking audience is culture, you know, in the way that, like, we are crossing these cultural boundaries in a way where we can, like, look at the differences and talk about the differences and acknowledge the differences without, like, making jokes or putting down the differences. And, like, I think that is the thin tightrope to walk. Are you being respectful? Are you not breaking it down? Are you not you know, making it less than just because it is different, you know, and then embracing the fact that it combining with you is something special and something exciting.
Yeah.
But that's hard to do. And that's, you know,
It's one of those eternal, because everyone will have different thoughts on it and everyone will have different feelings.
Right.
Cause it even comes down to, like, if I'm pronouncing Candela,
I'm
pronouncing that in a Spanish accent because it's a Spanish word.
Yeah. The fact that we've been saying Ivan and not Ivan.
Exactly.
Right.
You know what I mean? Because to me, all I'm doing is I'm being respectful of the language that it's from. If, you know, we don't call it Les Miserables.
Right. Exactly.
We call it Les Miserables.
I call it Les Miserables sometimes. But like even
you're a
fool. I know. Even in the, because I was going through this libretto, which is also, man, it's fascinating. I was just looking around. I don't know where this came from or if it's accurate or not, but it also has, because it is the West End version, it has British helper text to tell you what these words mean. Like at one point they say, someone says, I did the math, and in brackets it says maths with an S to tell you, like, oh no, they mean maths here. Or there's Peppa says to Candela, you're the smartest model I know, which, so, and this one I really had to unpack. If I say smartest in, like, British English, mean, like, smart and proper and, like, dutied up, right?
Yeah.
But smartest in American English says, as listed here in brackets, cleverest. And, like,
that's silly.
That's math and maths.
You couldn't, that is splitting hairs.
Right. But the math and maths, I'm sure they're saying, like, no, they would say math.
Yes.
Not
there's
maths.
There's nothing missed out there.
Right.
Yeah.
And, like, there are a couple, and this is in the Broadway version, too. Lucia has a line where she calls, she says, I'll have you know your puta just chased me through the streets.
Right, okay.
And puta is a Spanish word and means, like, whore. Or, you know, prostitute. Like, it's not a kind word. But is untranslated to give it. And, like, In the Heights does this But, you know, they might be blending Spanglish in real life, whereas here we're doing it, and it is saying, like, no, these characters are speaking Spanish to you, and this is, or speaking Spanish to each other, and this is how we're telling you, English audience, that we've kind of just put, like, the Doctor Who translators in our ears so that you can understand this.
Exactly. Because, correct me if I'm wrong, and if there is, it'll be one or two words, but there's barely any Spanish.
There's not a lot.
The soundtrack and the music.
Yeah, no, there's not, you know, there
if
could...
If there is any, do you know, like, yeah, you know what I mean?
Which I don't think there is. There, like, to the point where there could be so much more, and you would still understand it, right? Like, if they wanted to. And I think, you know, I wonder if that just has more to do with the fact that, like, David Yazbek doesn't speak Spanish. Doesn't write in Spanish.
Doesn't think
that way. That, you know, someone like Lin-Manuel Miranda might be able to pull a Spanglish rhyme that is more interesting than just a pure...
It's already in his vernacular.
Exactly.
It's,
and so
already things he's using.
He can think bilingually.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just find it. And then obviously the West End production throws a whole different slant on that because they're all speaking their native accent. And it's not everyone's English. So the guy playing the taxi driver is Spanish, or certainly of Spanish origin.
Descent. Or Spanish He's language
Ricardo
speaking,
Afonso.
Right?
Okay. Yeah, exactly. So he speaks... And actually, now that I'm looking at it, I forgot about this. So Wilhelmine, I don't know how to say her last name properly, but she's one of like the biggest elphabas that's ever existed.
Oh, okay.
And she is... Dutch, I think.
Ah.
But she doesn't speak in a Dutch accent.
Right. Yeah.
So what's going on there? Yeah, the guy who plays Ivan is the same guy. You'll know him. You've seen the Jesus Christ Superstar made for TV movie. Not the movie.
Not the recent one, but the yes.
The like contemporary one.
Yeah, like that set in like the early 2000s.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it's the guy who plays Judas, is the guy who plays Ivan.
Yes, okay.
He's a very distinctive vibrato.
Yes.
He's French.
And it's fascinating.
But
he speaks
French.
But he speaks. So, yeah.
It's so, and the fact though that the taxi driver, and it's weird though, of all of the characters to speak in a Spanish accent, to sing in a Spanish accent.
Right.
Because that's crucial as well. They don't sing in Spanish. They still just keep that in their native.
Right.
Is really interesting because it keeps the flavor of it.
Yeah,
right. Rooted in Spain.
Well, it feels like if they switch to their English accent, it's just going to pull you out of the story.
But that's the thing is with this story.
Yeah,
it doesn't need to be Spain.
Yeah, for sure.
The only thing is to do with the whole terrorism storyline.
Yeah,
because that's an issue in Madrid.
Yes,
but do you know what I mean?
Even you know, it does even get more complicated because at least in the Broadway version, they correctly pronounce Ivan's name with a Spanish Madridian accent, which would be different from say a Mexican Spanish accent.
Oh yes. Yeah, absolutely.
And a lot of the stuff, I think, goes back and forth between what is and isn't appropriate. But then, you know, where, like, does it become disrespectful to do a Mexican Spanish accent?
I know, exactly, because it's completely different.
Yeah. And you know, I haven't listened super closely with that in the back of my brain, but I'm sure Patti LuPone gets it wrong 1,000 times, right?
Most likely.
I mean, you know, if her German here again, gone again, war paint accent is anything to go by.
Exactly. I mean, her British accent.
Her anything accent.
Yeah.
You know, but so, no one's like, there's
I'm
no
this dream, you see.
Right. There's no big think piece on Vox.com about like, is Patti LuPone secretly American racist because she doesn't respect? Like, no!
Exactly.
Of course not. She's just bad at accents.
Yep.
Right? Yep. You know, it is another intent versus impact yep. sort of thing, and needs to be approached with I think sensitivity and reality.
I think that's it. I think that's all you really can do.
Yeah,
is to do that and just try. I don't, you know, you'll always offend somebody.
True,
but as long as your intentions are correct, you can sit pretty.
Yeah, well, I think there are ways even around that like savvy, you know, theater makers should be aware that they can do and things like that. Like, yeah. I think I might have mentioned this in our In the Heights episode. I'm sure I did because we talked about it. The first time I did In the Heights was at a North Suburban Chicago school with certainly, you know, a vast mix of backgrounds and appropriately cast kids and not appropriately cast kids.
Yeah,
You know, speaking of cultural backgrounds or racial backgrounds or however you want to delineate it. And the director wrote a really nice note that was in the program that was like, hey, you know, this is a story that we think is important to tell and is about acceptance. And we do the best we can. And that's all we can do. And in the context of a high school production, that's appropriate. In the context of a, you know, a Scottish production, that seems appropriate. Yep. You make do with what you have. So, maybe in the context of a West End production, if you're casting West End actors, maybe. Who knows? That's a hard one.
I know. It is. It's fascinating. And I think, you know, I would hate to think that all we'll ever see in the West End is British stuff.
Yeah.
Because we don't have enough Spanish people to play the roles.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that, you talk for hours on it.
I'm sure. It's hard. It's so hard because...
Because you lose out on so much culture. You lose out on so much storytelling.
Right. But then also if the standard becomes that, like, we're trying really hard to cast appropriately, so we're going to pay for someone to come over from wherever to live here for so long, and does that put a squeeze on the kind of stuff we produce? And then so do we just produce very British-centric pieces because they're the kind of, you know?
Yeah, totally.
That's hard. That's really, really hard. I am inspired by the fact that we are becoming a more global theatrical space, you know, I think in lots of directions, even things like, you know, Les Mis was produced first in French, you know, Wicked went to Japan, like we are embracing each other's arts in truly commercial, like, don't get me wrong. You know, no, they didn't bring Les Mis over to America so that we could experience this deep, important piece of French literature. They brought it over so Cameron McIntosh could make a lot of money.
Exactly,
But by the wayside, you get this kind of cross-pollination of cultures. And that is the sort of thing that can breed, you know, acceptance and oneness and whatever kumbaya terms you want to put around it.
Yeah.
All right, I'm going to put my soapbox away.
Thank you. I'll put mine away as well. We'll bring it out, no doubt.
Next episode. Man.
I love it, though, because it's a constant conversation.
Yeah.
And there's constantly things that will come into our world that will challenge it. You know what I mean?
For sure.
And that's exciting, isn't it?
Well, it is. You know, one of the cool things about theater is that it is such a huge art of collaboration, is that just by design, you have to have so many voices present. And so then getting diverse voices in whatever way possible, you know, might not be perfect, but is better than, you know, a lot of other art out there that is stuck in, like, well, this is just my opinion.
Yeah.
Boom.
But this is just our opinion.
And in a moment, love may vanish and turn to ashes suddenly. At least until that moment finds us, hold me tight and talk to me. Hold me tight and talk to me. And the movies of the laughing in a crazy sky, and the laughing and so
On the verge of a nervous breakdown, Jimmy.
It was. Hooray.
Do you feel like you've come back from the edge?
I'm off the edge. I've climbed down. It's all good. I'm calm though. I hope, because I don't think a lot of our listeners.
No, this one.
What are you doing today?
I had been aware of it and knew a couple songs off of it, but this was a new experience for me for this podcast, and I'm glad it was. It's part of my lexicon now.
Yeah, totally. It's a really good cast recording.
Yeah.
Regardless of anything else, it's a lot of fun.
It's really it's good songs, fun to listen to, worth a couple re-listens.
Yeah. You find and a knockout stuff. Cast. We've barely talked about that.
Starring cast, like across the board. That's what a lot of reviews said. Like, how could you waste this much time?
Yeah, exactly. I still don't agree. Anyway, it doesn't matter. We're moving on. What are we moving on to?
Well, I have a quiz question that might elucidate that a bit.
Elucidate?
Maybe. No,
but I
never
prefer elucidate.
I think I used that word wrong, but I'm going to continue to use it incorrectly.
I'm into it, even if it's not a word.
Isn't elucidate what they put around your gums when you're getting dental work done?
It is. No, elucidate, according to Urban Dictionary, is to masturbate and subsequently ejaculate while riding on public transport.
Well, so that's not what this quiz question will do for you, hopefully.
But, weirdly, topical to do with the show.
Speaking of our quiz question this week, which musical features a metallophone, an accordion, an auto harp, an eru, and a ukulele in its orchestration?
There can only be one. Only. I bet you there's like 50.
I know, we're going to learn all about them now.
If you would like to get in touch with us, you absolutely can. You can come find me over on Twitter or Instagram at AsInHendrix.
And I'm Musical Mash on Twitter and Musical Theater Mash on YouTube, or check out our show Twitter, Jim and Tomic, or our website, jimandtomic.com.
And that has a link to our Patreon page where you can come and contribute if you so desire. That's absolutely fine.
And we would appreciate it much. Tell your friends
all about us. Please do. And we shall see you next time.
Next time.
Don't you be time specific, boy.
I will see you in the future.
Or the past.
Ooh. Topical. Tomorrow is a podcast. Today, tomorrow, and yesterday, the podcast happened.
Olé.
Farting balloon.
Tremendous.
Hey, it's Leslie Odom Jr. here on the Broadway Podcast Network to tell you about the RISE Theater Directory, a program of Maestro Music. RISE is a national online resource designed to connect and empower backstage and administrative and creative theater professionals from underrepresented backgrounds. If you work or aspire to work in the theater community, this can help you find your next project. And if you hire theater professionals, search the RISE Theater Directory to find your next team. Create your profile now and get more information by visiting risetheater.org. That's theater with an RISETHEATRE.org. Because only together we rise.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.